How's it going? Thank you for checking back in or checking in for the very first time. Welcome to the program. One of the biggest stars in country music radio is Whitney Allen from The Big Time with Whitney Allen. Little girl once upon a time dreamed of being on the radio as a five-year-old has indeed made The Big Time. We talk life in the business, but she also lived through the Woolsey fire and how that changed her life, along with an encounter with the Mexican cartel. We talk success and failure, favorite celebrity interviews, online dating, and unconditional love. Let's get to it with one of my favorites. Here's Whitney Allen. One of the biggest stars in country music radio. Big Time with Whitney Allen from the School of Hard Knocks. You got a master's degree, right?
I did. Absolutely. Still earning it every day.
And now become a major radio personality. I'm so thrilled to talk to you because I go back with you. I don't want to mention the year because it kind of dates us, but I did look up.
I know people will do math.
Well, I did look up the songs that you played on Q106 with me.
Yeah.
The Jets, Pebbles, I'll Be Sure, Debbie Gibson, Gloria Estefan, and Terrence Trent D'Arby.
Oh, yeah. Sign your name.
Exactly. How did you make a transition from playing that kind of stuff to country?
You know, it was weird. My second job, I worked in Oceanside, California. I came from Eureka, and there was a station. I wanted to get to the LA market, and Eureka, you know, as you know, way up in California, San Diego, way down, but closer to LA. So I thought maybe if I can get closer, I'll have a better shot. And plus, I'd be closer to my mom. My mom wasn't in the best health. And well, that's not true. At that time, she was. But LA was the market that everyone wanted to be in, including me.
Yep.
So there was this job in this tiny station outside of San Diego that did nostalgia, and they did country, like nostalgia on the FM and country on the AM. And I just thought, this is my shot. So they hired me, and all I really did was run. They had these big automation machines that were, you know, they had reels to reels of one tape had songs, one tape had voices. The disc jockey was on a tape, and one other reel had commercials. And after that, so I got to know country music a little bit. But soon after that, every time I got a top 40 job, a country station would come in saying, come over here. I'm just like, dude, I don't know country music. This happened over and over and over again. I got my first San Diego job at KS103 before Q106.
Yep.
And KCBQ wanted to hire me. And I'm like, dude, I can't do it. I'm working at KS103. And then they gave me all this dirt on KS103. They go, you know, you're getting paid less than anyone else. I'm like, I'm what? They're like, yeah, but you're a chick. And true. And eventually, I ended up working in back up in Carlsbad, California, again, outside of San Diego. And man, I hope I'm remembering all these right. It's all coming to me like so easily. It's almost like I'm making it up. So I hope it's right, you know. But it was right next door to where I lived. Like literally, I could have walked there. Only time in radio this ever happened. And then immediately when I got that job, I moved like 50 miles away or something stupid, you know, because I had to buy a house and couldn't afford anything where I was working. And KCBQ said, well, come work for us. So I was working top 40 during the week and country on the weekends. Fast forward a lot to Kiss FM. I was working with a guy named Blair Garner. And I think he was using the name Blair Michaels at Kiss. And he left to start his own country show and said, come over and we'll do a show. And I'm like, dude, I'm working at Kiss. I can't. This is my dream job. I mean, this is where I wanted to work. And about 6 months after that, I was transitioned out, and I called Blair, and I'm like, hey, guess what? And he's like, give me 6 months. And it's true. He gave me he made me a weekend show. He created a weekend show for me called After Midnight Weekends. And that was all she wrote. I never went back.
I can't believe you used the phrase, I transitioned out. I love that.
I think I just used that.
That's crazy.
So feel free.
Yeah.
Takes all the bitterness out of it.
Of being blown out.
Yeah.
Well, what happened there? I mean, you're a great jock. In fact, I've told my friends, I think it's kind of condescending when people say, oh, she's a great female jock. I thought you were just a great jock, period. Forget the gender.
Oh, thanks, man.
You know, no matter what, that you could bring it no matter what format. So what happened there?
At KISS, you know, I'll never really know. And if I really told you the story, I'd have to drop like some really big names, which would make me really uncomfortable. I don't know. I did everything right. I remember the day that it happened. I had gone on vacation, which is never a good idea. And when I came back, I went to do my show and I saw this guy like walking around the halls. And I'm a friendly person. You know me. It's a guy that kind of brought him in to introduce. I'm like, hey, nice to meet you and whatever. And this guy couldn't look me in the eye. It was bizarre. He couldn't look me in the eye. And I thought, there's something weird that's happening here. And at the end of that shift, I got blown out. And they just said, you know, we're going in another direction. And I mean, of course, this is a million years ago. And KISS is completely different now than it was back then. Completely different. But back then, they just, I don't know, Dave. To this day, I don't know.
Because that would be, like you said, your dream job. I know for me, I just want to do one shift there. I've always wanted to work there. That to me would be the ultimate, to say those call letters just one time. So I can imagine how much that hurt you. But you were able to go from there to the part-time country gig.
Exactly. And that was great. You know, I loved KISS. I loved working there. I loved working at Pirate, which was a rock format before KISS. That's where I went to right before KISS, I went to... That's why I left San Diego, actually, because I ended up with you at KS103. I'm sorry, with you at Q106, and I went from Q106 to Pirate Radio. And at that point, my mom's health was really bad. And even the 90 minutes at that time from San Diego to Los Angeles was a little bit too much. And I ended up working up for Scott Shannon. And, dude, we could do like 5 hours on that alone.
Oh, Whitney, I turned down working over. I didn't want to work overnight, but the overnight job I had offered was from Pirate, you know, when they first went on the air. And I just did, I was doing
we
nights.
We could work together there.
That would have been awesome. But I didn't want to work, you know, 2 to 6.
Yeah. No, I get it. I've worked 2 to 6 and it's a tough gig. But that was an unbelievable time, an unbelievable format. Even if people didn't listen to it, and it seemed like everyone listened to it. It was played on all the stores on Melrose. And, you know, people would think of, Whitney Allen, she must be really cool. And I'm like, I'm anti-cool. I'm like so not cool.
Please, you're cool.
That when I would like go on to Melrose, which was way out of character for me, and they'd be listening to Pirate, I didn't want to tell them that I worked there because I thought, oh, it's going to be a letdown when they meet me. I'm so not rock and roll. You know what I mean?
You're cool no matter the format. Come on.
So anyway, so that was it. And then KISS and then country ever since. And it's been... I have such an appreciation. And you probably know this because you work Top 40 too. Not that many Top 40 artists, except maybe if you're doing mornings, will come into your show. And fewer than that will sing live. Am I right?
Oh, you know what? I wanted to ask you about that because I think the thing you do best is interview. And in sports, I think the hockey guys are the best. They're the most down-to-earth, real. You can talk to them about stuff. Do you feel like the country artists are that way in terms of music?
They are. It's not just a feeling. I'm telling you, dude. They are, and they're talented. They can come in with a guitar or without a guitar and put on a show. No production, nothing, you know, crappy little microphones, sitting in a chair, and they blow me away every time. Every time.
Who are your favorites that have come in to talk to you?
I'll tell you what, hands down, it's a no-brainer for me. It was the very first visit that I had from Keith Urban. Hands down. He was a brand new guy. From Australia. He had a band in Australia, but he came into the studio at After Midnight Weekends. And I remember I'd gone through a horrible breakup with someone. And they said, can we bring in this guy, Keith Urban, on Friday night? And I said, I don't know, man. Is he cute? Like I was despondent. Yeah. I was just down. And they're like, yeah, he's cute. Well, he came in. And back then, you know, now when you do an interview on the radio, you go to it, then you edit it down, right? Back then, we were doing them all live. So here's Keith play his song. His song was Love Somebody Like You. Somebody Like You. And play the song, and as the song's playing, he starts asking me about my favorite music. I tell him, you know, loved country since I was a little kid. My parents listened to very top 40 country, even though there was no top 40 then. Like, they loved Glenn Campbell. They loved folks like that. And Wichita Lineman from Glenn Campbell remains one of my top five favorite songs of all time. We come back from commercial break, and I ask Keith what he's going to play next from the album, and he plays Wichita Lineman. Now, this is a guy, he's a brand new artist. He's got stuff to sell on his own. He plays Wichita Lineman, and I'm telling you.
For you.
Yeah, for me. And it was just one of those moments when I just think, this guy didn't know me from Adam. This guy's just starting a career in the U.S., and dang if he's not playing this song for me. And it was unbelievable. I have it somewhere on tape. I've never put it on the internet or anything because it was so special. And, you know, there's all those rights and stuff sometimes you have to deal with, too, and I don't want to deal with that. I certainly don't want to tick him off because he's a fantastic human being. Outside of performer, singer, songwriter, he's an amazing person.
I've seen your pictures with him on Instagram. You've got a little extra smile when you pose with him.
He and I laugh about it. Like, we go back, dude. We go back 20 years.
What do you think Whitney makes a good interviewer? Because I've listened to some, in fact, this afternoon getting ready to talk to you. I heard a great one with Luke Bryan and Trace Adkins talking about getting hit in the groin with a golf ball. And And Charles Esten, you know, before the benefit show. I mean, what do you have to do to make yourself a great interviewer, and what do they bring to the table for you?
I don't really, thank you. I don't consider myself a great interviewer at all. I do have, the thing that I have that I have to like calm down on a little bit is I have real excitement for the format and for the artists. I love watching like Luke Bryan. I've known him since the start too. And I get really excited for these guys. And one thing I have to do is I have to take our kind of, not that we hang out on the weekends or even call or text, but kind of I have to take our personal history out of it a little bit, because then I think it tends to get a little too inside. And I think there's a fine line between being inside and being relatable, if that makes sense.
You go to the Super Bowl at Luke Bryan's house and talk about him adopting an 18-year-old dog. That's cool.
I know. And Super Bowl, Luke Bryan's house. It's like, is that interesting or is that boasting? I don't know. So I have to make the decision. I don't think I always make the right decision on which way to go in an interview, but I'm glad you like them. You can feel if you're going to have a rapport with the artist. There are some people you just don't have it with. Through nobody's fault, there's like no chemistry. There's other artists who might be brand new that just don't know where to go. There's other artists who've done this for so long, they're just sick of the whole thing. You know what I mean? So I have to be kind of prepared to go either way. I have all my notes, but when we're doing a festival, like we just did the Stagecoach Music Festival, and that one wasn't too bad, but we do the Academy of Country Music Awards or the Country Music Association Awards, and they're bringing artists at you so quickly, like one after another. There are times you don't have you don't have time to get to the notes that were sent to you. And sometimes I'll sit down, I'll go, dude, I know nothing about you. What should I know?
Right?
And it's a cop-out, but it's honestly, it's the best I got. You know, it's the best I got. Most of the artists I hear like being interviewed by me because we go way off topic. There's a artist from, he was just on American Idol a few weeks back, from Orange County. And somehow we got talking about, one of my producers was talking about, like, I don't know how you guys do this. Shave your Adam's apple. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? It's just a weird. And for whatever reason, he came on, and he's a really tall guy. He has a really long neck. And I'm like, hey, Brett Young. It's Brett Young. I say, Brett, hey, we're just talking about, like, Adam's apples. Like, how do you – you got a pretty big Adam's apple there. How do you deal with it? And he's telling me, and then he goes, but I also have this other thing. He goes, you know that neck hole that you have under – and I'm like, well, yeah. He goes, I have, like, a scar tissue in there that I like my girlfriend to itch to, like, get down there. Scratch.
Oh my.
It's like, so they will go way off topic with me and remember. And I think that's how you get memorable stuff.
Oh, sure.
How they will remember you is you talk to me about my damn neck hole. Who does that? You know?
Has there been anybody that you were nervous? Like, I can't believe I'm going to talk to. Ah! And you got a little bit of a starstruck, or you just real with everybody?
No, the guy who, and he was unbelievably great in an interview. I think I've only interviewed him one time. Kenny Rogers.
Yeah.
Because when I was a little kid, I remember Kenny Rogers from a song called Ruby, Don't Take Your Love to Town. Do you know that song?
I don't, but I'll find it.
Yeah, it was Kenny Rogers in the first edition, I want to say. And I think he was with the Kingston Trio. That's probably wrong. But anyway, this Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town, when I was a little kid, dude, I had no idea what this song was about. It's about a whore, you know? I'm pretty sure. That was my favorite song. And then Kenny Rogers was just, you know, he was everywhere, like in the 70s and I think up to the early 80s and with Dolly, Islands in the Stream. We played Kenny Rogers stuff as top 40 music.
Yep, lady.
I was out of my flipping mind. I had to do laps around the not even the studio, the entire floor of the building because I was a wreck. And he was great. He came in, we bonded because he was a Diet Coke fanatic like me. I gave it up like a year ago, but he was a Diet Coke fanatic. And that was the thing, the connection I found with Kenny Rogers. And at the time, I think I said to him, you know, dude, you've been making music since the 50s. And at the point when I interviewed him, he said for the first time he thought that he was actually, this was his fifth decade of making music. And it was like, dude, that's 50 years.
What a career.
And this is, yeah, and this is a long time ago, but he was the one who made me nervous. And for no reason, because most of these country music artists, oh my God, they're incredible. They're wonderful. They're easy. They're fantastic.
I'm going to play this part of the interview for the audience, but it is the Trace Atkins talking about getting hit in the groin with a golf ball. What do you remember about that whole incident? Because it was pretty funny.
Trace pulled his pants down.
Yep.
Because you'd been hit in the groin with a golf ball.
That's right.
And you wanted to show us the bruise.
Yeah, I had a bruise. I remember.
But we thought you were mad.
Oh.
Right? Because when you stood up and started to pull your pants, I have no idea what's happening. One of my favorite radio moments in hindsight.
Good.
Did it make you nervous when I stood up there and unzipped my pants?
Just I'm now? Starting to get, you know, I was okay.
All right. I'm trying to get the feeling that we had back in the day. It was frightening. So, I know a weird conversation we just had here, but that's how Trace and I have always rolled.
That's right.
Okay. This was Stagecoach Music Festival, and I want to say it was about 10 years ago. Now, Trace at the time, ask anyone, ask him, big drinker. This guy had so many injuries. He had a tractor roll over on him. He got shot. He has a bullet hole. And, you know, he'll tell you after he quit drinking, he will tell you, you know, he got all those things because he was drinking. So he was a little bit of a loose cannon. You kind of never knew who was coming in when Trace Atkins was coming in. So he came in, and my producer, Justin, it's funny, Justin is my producer now. He was my original producer like 15 years ago. And when Trace came in, Justin was wearing his pants really low, like almost below his butt where his boxers were hanging out. And I said to Trace, you know what? I got to apologize for Justin. I apologize for his butt sticking out there of his pants. And Trace Atkins, who's huge, he's like 6'7". And then he's wearing cowboy boots, so he's 6'9". He stands up, and I have no idea where this is going. He stands up, and he goes, you know what? And he went for the belt on his pants, and I had no idea where this was going.
Were you freaking out?
Yes. I didn't know if he was pissed. I didn't know if he was drunk. I didn't know what was happening. And he dropped his pants, and I still don't know what's going on. And he pulled up his those boxer briefs on, to show that thank God it was on his thigh. He had taken a line drive from a golf ball, and the bruise on his inner thigh was completely out of hand. But it was the moments leading up to that. Like, where is this going? What is happening? But again, when we talked to him, it was the benefit for the shooting that went down very close to my house at Borderline, that, you know, he remembered that. And I'll never forget that.
You know, when you talk about that, in fact, I heard some of your show leading up to that event, very emotional. And you could really see that this obviously literally hits close to home, but it means a lot to you.
It was, I got to tell you, man, that when the Vegas shooting happened, my producer at the time, Jackie, was there. And I mean literally there. I don't mean she was in the vicinity. She had just left the backstage area where Jason Aldean was playing. She had just left. And I was getting ready to go to bed, and I saw CNN say, I can't even remember, it was a very small number. It was like too many, but, you know, two people shot, five people injured in Vegas. And I immediately started texting Jackie, who had had just left and now was inside of a Vegas building where her cell service wasn't great. So I wasn't getting an answer. And I'm trying to get her on Facebook, like, we all should have been at that show. And it was, we were going to be at the show and then they didn't need us or something. And then literally a week before the show, they invited us back and said, you know, please come out. And it was just like, dude, it's a week away. We can't get someone in the studio to run the show and take four of us out there to do the show. And so the fact that like Jackie was still there and we weren't there with her, it was just too much. And then, God, you know, less than a year later, I was asleep. I had just gotten back from Italy. I was on this huge trip. And Garrett, my, as I refer to him, the guy that I live with, he was coming back from Turkey. He had gone to Turkey. And he was flying, I think, out of Moscow. And they were, like, sweeping his plane for bombs. And I woke up about 2 in the morning just to check and see if he texted me. And the first thing I saw when I opened my phone was a neighbor of mine had marked herself safe at the borderline shooting. And I don't, I tell you what, dude, I don't have words for that. To see your neighbor at another country venue that I've been to for fun, I've worked there, I know people who work there, and it was like, why do they freaking keep hitting on us? Now, that was not the case, it doesn't seem, although they've been very quiet about borderline. This was a guy who was mentally disturbed. There are not many things that are open late in this area. I think this guy was just looking for a crowd, and the country music crowd was an easy crowd. And yeah, I don't have words. And everyone who lives in this area, I don't know anyone personally who died there, but I will tell you, people who are not connected with country music, so many of them, my gardener, I had a guy doing construction on my house, like his niece was there. This one's teacher was shot. That one's, you know, brother's girlfriend was shot. It was unbelievable. And we didn't get a chance to dwell on that because it was the day after that shooting, the Woolsey fire broke out. Exact same area. I mean, within 3 miles, maybe. So it was, I gotta tell you, November of 2018 was just an unbelievable, unbelievable month. Unbelievable.
Your exchange with Charles Esten from Nashville was pretty memorable to me because you were talking about the performance, but also what the event means and that the folks in country music are rallying to reach out and help and that darkness will not prevail.
People just rise up and come along and bring love and light to those that need it. And in the end, I think that's why the darkness will never win, because one man's evil insanity seems to rebound and it destroys lives and breaks hearts, but in its echo is so many people coming together to try to help in some way, in some small way. And I used to not really understand what music could do, but maybe being on the show Nashville, we touched on that theme so much. And it's not just we touched on it on the show, but people would come up to me, as they come up to every artist that you're going to hear tonight or every artist you're ever going to hear in country or in any other genre, and they tell them that music heals and that music can touch places that sometimes words can't. So again and again, I find that.
It's the thing that gets us through.
Yeah, it is.
In so many instances.
I don't know why that is. It's the closest thing to a prayer, I guess, music sometimes.
You're right. Well, I tell you what, I mean, what he said is true, and I've always thought of this really in the darkest moments, is that it goes back to Martin Luther King, but go into the darkest room you can imagine, the darkest one, and how big is that room? Even if it's 10 by 10, you light a little tiny candle, and it freaking lights up that room. I mean, you cannot keep the darkness. The darkness can be exposed, is what I'm saying, and all it takes is a little bit of light to get it started. And it sounds trite, and I'll tell you what else sounds trite. Thoughts and prayers sound trite. And I will never forget that moment of the borderline shooting when there was a sheriff on the TV. And he said, look, I know that thoughts and prayers sounds very cliche at this point, but we'll take anything we can get, you know? So I know the same way with lighting a candle in the dark might sound cliche, but I'm telling you, it makes a difference, you know?
Does that strengthen your faith? I don't know where you're at with that before, but does it maybe make you reach out more and cling on to something when you have tragedy in your life?
Well, I think that you just appreciate things more, you know, and I'm someone who's kind of seen it from the sidelines. You know, Jackie was in Vegas. My neighbors were at borderline, but I was right on the fringe of that. And I feel very thankful that I can still function. There was a lot of people because we all see, there are a group of us who see each other backstage as a lot of things. And the first huge event after that Vegas shooting was the Stagecoach Music Festival about 6 months later. And there were people who were backstage, like me doing the interviews, could not walk into that crowd. They could not walk into that crowd. And I get that. You know, I'm thankful that I can still walk into a crowd, although I will also think a couple times when I hear a noise, whereas they will hit the floor. It just, that's PTSD straight up, you know? And so my thoughts to these people who were right there in the thick of this, and yeah, it's a horrible thing to think about. It was a horrible thing to have lived through, but thank God, you know, most of us did live through it, you know?
I remember seeing a Facebook post when you saying you were safe with the Woolsey fire. How close were you to that?
Oh, it took out 32 of my direct neighbors. Direct. It was literally from where I sit right now. I can see, it's funny because they just started clearing the lots. And this happened in November, and they just started clearing the lots in April. I could see three burnouts from my front window, where there were only chimneys left. And there's one, they started cleaning up the one directly across from me. It's still there today. So, I felt the heat of the flames. That's how close it was. I felt the heat of the flame.
Well, how'd you deal with the evacuation and getting the hell out of there?
Stupidly. Garrett, this is the thing, is Garrett arrived home at 5 o'clock, and I had come back from Italy 3 days ahead of time, and 3 days ahead of that, and I had, or Malta, actually, Italy to Malta, and then Malta back to here. And I was having horrible insomnia because I was on Europe time. So I hadn't slept well all week. And he walks in 5 o'clock, and he fell asleep. And it was like, oh, wow. I laid down. It's like, oh, my God, I'm going to fall asleep too. This is great. I haven't fallen asleep in 3-4 days. Well, I knew this fire had broken out, but it was quite far from here. I couldn't understand why they were talking about it getting near our house. This fire is way too far away. And there's a freeway here called the 101, which is 3 miles from my house. And they said, well, as long as it doesn't jump the 101, we're safe. And I'm like, all right, we're safe. Well, from my bed, I have a photo of the orange glow that I could see. The fire looks much closer than it was. It wasn't close. It was 3, 4, 5. It was probably 7 miles away. The entire sky was orange though. So I had fallen asleep. I woke up around midnight and I saw this orange glow. 2 a.m., sheriffs come by and they say, it's time to evacuate. I look out the window. I'm like, no, that fire has not jumped the 101. Turn on the news. Fire has not jumped the 101. I'm like, well, I'm not leaving. Fire hasn't jumped the 101. It's 6 miles away. What's going on? Woke up at 7 a.m. And we fell back asleep. We were so exhausted from the Europe and woke up and it was directly, I'm looking now. I saw the flames. I took a picture and I didn't realize it when I looked back. It was the top of the hill at like whatever, 601. 602, it was down the hill. I mean, this thing was moving. I said, you know what, babe, we should go. And we went to grab the important papers. Listen, y'all, get your important papers together because we knew we had important papers, but they were spread out over 8 boxes. Those 8 boxes were all dumped into 1 box and went in the car. We still have yet to figure them all out. I took the weirdest things with me. Like the oddest things. I almost said I'll take the computers and the photographs. No, I didn't do that. I took a clock. I took a magnifying mirror. I mean, you're not thinking. You're not thinking. And the winds were unbelievable. This heat I was talking to, I was in my yard looking back. We live on a lake. And so I was looking across the lake and all of a sudden my left arm got incredibly hot. And I said, oh God, our neighbor's tree just got on fire. And when I looked, it's like, it wasn't, it was from across the lake. I could feel the fire and I'm not a very wide part of the lake. And the winds came up. They cut all the power, or the power was cut. So we had no power, no phone, no internet. I said, well, let's head over to Malibu because we're not going towards the 101 because the fire is right here. We didn't know that the fire had gone kind of around our house and was now in the canyon on the way to the ocean. So we get in the car and it's just, I got the three dogs, he's got the cat, he's ahead of me. And we make this turn and it turns absolutely pitch black. I can't see his car in front of me, except his brake lights matched everything that was on fire on either side of the road. Trees, telephone poles, bushes. I drive a soft top convertible. There was stuff falling on the car. I couldn't see. We couldn't see where we were going. And I had that moment of, oh God, I'm going to die. Then it was, no. And then my brain went like this. Oh God, I'm going to die. I'm not going to die like this. I'm going to die. I'm not going to die like this. And I had my hand on my three dogs who were totally calm in the passenger seat. And I just said, God, please don't let me die like this. Just please don't let me die like this. I mean, it was harrowing. I mean, if there had been a tree, Dave, across that road, a branch, we wouldn't have made it. We wouldn't have made it.
You kept driving.
We kept driving. Luckily, it was not a very long stretch. I think it was 4 minutes, which felt like hours. It felt like hours. We get to Canaan, which is the big street. And again, Garrett's ahead of me, and we have a cell signal, I think. Did we? Maybe there was no signal because he was ahead of me, and I stopped, and the fire was all on the left. There was a canyon there, and the fire was on the far side of the canyon, so I could kind of stand at the overlook. And I just thought I kind of needed some air. And I said to this guy who was standing there with his kids or his wife, I said, are you local? And he goes, oh, we're from up in, I can't remember what city he said. And I fell apart. You know, I just said, oh my God, I thought I was going to die. And this, you know, here's this poor guy. And I just, it was all the adrenaline and all of that. And I couldn't get a hold of Garrett. And I had to stop the car. I had to talk to someone. I had to let it out. You know, and after I did that, I was okay. And then we went down to Malibu, and for whatever reason, we expected the Starbucks to be open. So we're sitting there, kind of getting a breather, and then we got evacuated from there. So it's like, oh, it was unbelievable. It was truly, and things for 2 weeks were crazy. They had roadblocks up. We couldn't get in. We couldn't get out. If you could get out, you couldn't get back in. Didn't matter what. The rules changed all the time. It was unbelievable. We lived at the house with no electricity, no gas. We had this because I couldn't go out and be sure of getting back in. My producers came up to the house. We did the show on a laptop battery, and they took it back to the station. So what we did, I think I took 2 days off, and that was it.
So you went through this harrowing experience, you know, with the fire, but that's not the only thing. In fact, we swapped some messages about this, and I'm blown away about this Mexican cartel story. What's that about?
It's actually, I know no one will believe me when I say it's actually kind of humorous, but it actually was. We were driving. We drive once a year from the U.S. border down to almost the very tip of Mexico. We're about an hour away from Belize. And it's the most beautiful drive, and the people are fantastic. And we were crossing one day on a Sunday over to Mexico. And the border towns really, if there's going to be an issue, it's going to be in a border town. You get down into the vast majority of Mexico, and there's really no issue. So I almost hate to add to this big legend that, oh, Mexico's going to kill you, because I've been many times, and I've yet to be beheaded. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, really?
I still have my head.
Okay.
Yeah, still have it. But we crossed the border, and people had said, well, you know, go on a Sunday when all the cartel members are in church, which I found hilarious. And so we did that, and we were driving, and we saw this big, I think it was a red, I'm not sure, it was a red or black SUV, go past us at a huge, just a big rate of speed. And we saw some things come flying out the window. And it ended up, they were pieces of rebar, like you would find in construction, and they were molded or bent and welded together in the shape of like jacks that, like, that you would throw as a kid. And no matter how they landed spikes up. So we thought, for whatever reason, we thought the police had thrown these out. And we're like, well, that's a horrible way to stop someone who's breaking the law, because you're getting all the people on the freeway, you're giving them all flat tires. Then we realized, oh, that was probably the cartel in this big SUV. And we're laughing. We stopped our car, and we actually picked up some of these jacks and kept as souvenirs. 10 minutes later, here comes another SUV behind us, incredibly fast, again, over 100 miles an hour. And a guy leans out the back and just throws a handful of these things all over the highway. But we were the second car in line behind this cartel guy when they did this. The first car in front of us was a police car. The police car got 2 flat tires. Luckily, we only got 1. But the people behind us, everybody was ended up with 2, 3, 4 flat tires because of these primitive little rebar spikes that were all over the road. So we had 3 dogs. We pulled over. The cops fixed their own tires and then fixed ours. And I got to say, we were there for about a couple of hours. But, you know, we were at this tiny restaurant, parked outside, and they brought us food and they brought us drinks, just like the nicest people. But it wasn't a daily occurrence there. We just happened to be there on a day when the cartel was in action. And really, no bullets flew. That's the whole thing, is, you know, people always say, well, the cartel's going to get you. Usually not. If you stay out of drug dealers' dens and strip clubs, they never target tourists. We're just bystanders. And we have a great souvenir and a great story. So there you go.
Well, so who were those spikes intended for then?
The cops. The cops were chasing them, and so they were trying to give the cops the flat tires. And they were successful. They did it.
And you still have those jacks as souvenirs?
I have one of them, yeah. I have one of them. It's quite the entertainment piece. Like, huh, well, this is nice art. This is nice art. What is this? It's like, well, sit down. Let me tell you about our running with the hotel. It sounds so badass, you know. We were just tourists, but... Again, you know, at least there were no guns involved. So there's that.
Do you put it on the shelf like a trophy?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's bizarre wit.
Yeah, it was kind of crazy because it really did start off as a ha ha ha, there's the cartel. And by the time the second one went by, it's like, oh, dude, that is the cartel, because they all drive the really nice big SUVs. I don't know. It's like a badge of, hi, we're with the cartel. I don't know. They're not very undercover.
And you were saying that the cartel's in church on Sundays. I'm sure there's like a big line at the confessional, right? There's a lot of things to come clean about.
I would hope. They're not exactly the best guys.
When we started this podcast, Whit, I heard the dogs barking, and I heard them there just a second ago. So how many, who are they, and what do they mean to you?
Well, hang on. One just ripped my headphones out of my my head. I kid you not. One
how
just
sweet.
Stepped on my lap and ripped the headphones out of my
how
headphones.
Sweet.
But I have 3 now. And it's funny, growing up, I always had small to mid-sized dogs, and I was always like, when I grow up, I'm getting big dogs. So I had big dogs, like, for years. And this one dog, I don't know, about 10 years ago, fell in love with my golden retriever, this little dog that lived in the neighborhood. And this dog would not leave. We would take her back home, and she would sit in her yard and just howl and howl. It's like, all right. So we ended up adopting her. She was like a Lhasa Opso. Ish type of dogs. And as she got older, I realized, you know, when she couldn't walk, she literally couldn't walk anymore. She was having a fine life. She was eating. She loved her bed. She couldn't walk anymore. So I had to take her outside to pee and all this kind of stuff. And I realized, God, what's going to happen to my big dogs when they get old? And actually the same thing happened. And because we've had quite a few big dogs. And my back had a hard time dealing with the last 2 big dogs. Trying to get them up and down the stairs and getting them outside. I mean, I would have done it my whole life. You know, if they would have lived many years longer, I gladly would have done it. But I realized that in all good conscience, I'm not getting any younger and big dogs aren't getting any lighter. So we didn't mean to. We just ended up transitioning into bringing smaller dogs into the house. So now I have 3 small dogs. 2 are rescues from Mexico and 1 right off the street, one of them. And 1 is just from up the street. And they, you know, all these dogs come to me and they're all blonde and I don't choose them. They just show up at my house like this. I don't go looking for them. And so I have 3 dogs that look, for all intents and purposes, exactly the same, but in different sizes. They're all small. I can carry them around.
They all know where there's love. Your place.
Yeah, they show up and they don't leave, and they live forever. My big dogs live to be, like my golden, I think, was 15. My other dog, another rescue from Mexico, Paloma, she was about 13. And for a dog that grew up in Mexico, that is a very, very long life. You know, a lot of them don't make it to one or two. There's a huge population problem down there, as there is all over the world. Please spay and neuter your pets, y'all. Please do that.
I saw the post on Paloma. I didn't even know Paloma, but I saw the post when you had to put her down or when she passed away. And it's heartbreaking. It's obviously to you like losing a child.
Oh, it is. It is. She was pretty amazing. You know, people see these dogs living on the beach in Mexico and they go, oh, great. What a life. I'm like, yeah, they don't get into houses a lot. They don't get to have food a lot. It's really not that great of life. And people wondered, you know, when you bring this dog home, how is she going to adapt? It's like, dude, I tell you what, Paloma saw the couch and like never looked back. You know, she was like, I'll be right here. She was fantastic. She was a tiny bit of a problem dog. You know, you couldn't trust her around everyone because for years she was a watchdog and she knew that was her job. And, but boy, if she loved, and she never really attacked anyone, but she would do this, she was such a coward. It would be people walking away and she would go after their ankles. Again, she never broke skin, but it was scary as hell. You know, all of a sudden you're like, oh, there's your nice dog. Hey, Paloma. And then you turn to walk away. She'd be like, rah.
For people that don't have pets, they don't get it, you know, because it is like a person, and you get the unconditional love. And I'm around the dogs more than I am people, so I cried more with my German Shepherd going down than, you know, some aunt I hadn't seen in 25 years.
It's true, and what you do is you so miss their company on a daily basis, and you know, some are harder than others to lose. My dog Ramon, who's my midsize, a really tragic story. We had adopted the dog of my life. Everybody, you know, no one wants to say they have favorites, but as a friend said to me, some just get under your skin more than others. And she was this remarkable little tiny dog named Chiquita, and she fell in love with my golden retriever too. And she came to us, and I swear to God, she was my soul dog. I swear to God, I don't have words for her. And she had a disease which is spread by ticks in southern parts of the U.S. where it's very wet, and also in Mexico where it's very humid. Tropical climates and humid climates have these ticks that spread this disease called Ehrlichia. Paloma had it. There's three stages to it. I won't get all into it. Paloma had it. Maddie, my golden retriever, had it. And Chiquita had it. And most dogs, when they have the onset, you can treat them with antibiotics and they're fine. Well, Chiquita was only 18 months old, and she got very sick one day, and we took her to the vet, and she died. God, she was 18 months old. And she died 4 days later, and this is 4 years ago, I have yet to get over it. And honest to God, Dave, I didn't know how I was going to go on. True story, I didn't know. We were in Mexico at the time, and we were on vacation. I said, that's it, we're going home. There's nothing left for me, there's nothing left. And it was about 2 days after she had died, and I had her ashes. We were driving in the car. We were driving back to the house to get our stuff and pack, because it was over for me. I cried every day for 5 months, every day. But as we're driving back in, I said, you know, what if Chiquita has a brother or a sister? What if? Just put it out there. And that night, I just kind of got fired up, and I went on Facebook, and I tracked down where Chiquita came from. I asked around town, where's this woman who had Chiquita? They said, oh, she's out of town for the holidays. And I said, do you know if there was any puppies after Chiquita? And they're like, you know, we don't know. The day before we were leaving, it was nighttime, and I got this email, all written in Spanish. I thought I found her online. I sent her this long, just incoherent Spanish message, because my Spanish is passable, but it's not that great. And she wrote me and she said, I do have a dog who is Chiquita's brother from a second litter, and I would love to give him to you. And that's how I got her brother, Ramon, who I have now.
Wow.
And I don't know how I would have made it. I still don't know how I made it. It was still rough. Like I said, I cried every day for 5 months. She was such a loss. But I have her brother. And at the same time, everyone was saying, oh, take this other dog off the street. Take this other dog. And how could I say, I can't take this other dog off the street. I'm looking for Chiquita's brother. So Garrett and I made a deal. I said, you know, I'll definitely take that dog off the street. That dog needs a home. As long as you let me take Chiquita's brother or sister. At this point, we didn't know one existed. I'll take two of them as long as I can take Chiquita's brother or sister. Wow. And so that's how we ended up with two dogs on that trip. So.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
With someone,
and they,
told
they
me,
look exactly like.
Someone told me a great line about dogs. I think it'll hit home for you. You know, obviously they don't live nearly as long as we do. And so she told me it's God's way of being able to have more dogs in your life.
I tell you what, I am, if I make it to heaven, this is my first question to God. Like, why do you do this to us, dude? Why can't you make him live longer? I'm telling you, I think it's a healthy thing to have questions, and that that is my question, because I can count the dogs I've had in my life. You know, it's a lot, but it's really not that many, and I'd give just about anything to have every single one of them back. I would have taken care of every single one of them every day of my life. Those are soulmates, those dogs.
I can tell your heart's in the right place. Hey, what do you do with the dogs? I mean, you travel, you go to Nashville, you live, you've got this radio thing. So how hard is it to take care of multiple pets? That's my biggest. I can't go anywhere because I've got all these animals and I love them, but I just know that that's the priority.
It is. It's not easy. I remember when I was single, the question was, do you want to have a dog or do you want to have a boyfriend? I mean, true story, because you can't leave them just hanging, you know, fending for themselves. I mean, you can't do the kids either. But the dogs never grow up old enough to leave them alone. So we have a house sitter who costs, between the, you know, the three dogs, it costs more to have her stay here than it does for us to get a hotel room, you know, somewhere else. But there's no way. I can't put them into a kennel. I can't take them out of their house. So that when we go on vacation, unless we go away for a month, when we drive, we take them. And last year, after the Woolsey fire, We actually, and I, you know what, there's a lot of controversy about this, but we needed emotional support animals after that Woolsey fire. And we had Leela, who was our straight up street dog from Mexico, and Ramon. We got permission to take them on the plane with us. And my tiny little dog, who I call the Bird, he was in a little soft-sided container. We had three dogs on this plane, and I kept thinking before we went, if they cancel this ESA program, man, it's my fault. It's my dogs. I'm going to ruin it for everyone. But I tell you what, my dogs acted like they'd been flying every day of their life. They are not, because of some of the circumstances that one of them came from, you know, they're not, hey, you know, here I am. Come on, let me get on your lap. But at the airport, they were like ambassadors for the U.S., ambassadors for ESAs. People stopped, were like, oh my God, your dogs are so good. It was, they stepped up. So we took them on the plane back and
they
forth.
They stepped up.
5 hours. They stepped up, dude. And they knew I needed them too. I can't have anybody peeing in the airport. You know, I was telling them, dude, you got to hold it. They were absolutely flawless. And people were kind of worried. I could see the looks on their face when we get in the plane with two dogs on a leash and one in a crate. They were like, or a carrier. They were like, what the hell is happening? My dogs were golden. They were golden. But they also travel. If we drive in December, it takes about a week. And they're in the car, and they dig it. They get their beds. They get their food. They get to go on walks. They get to look out the window. They're loving it. That's the thing about dogs, man. They'll go anywhere with you. They don't ask questions. They're like, can I be with you? I'm in.
That, to me, would be an ultimate road trip on my little to-do list, is go down to a place like Monterey or Carmel and put the dogs in the car, just hop in and cruise that 101. That'd be sweet.
Yeah, although if you haven't done it, watch out. Sometimes they get car sick.
Well, yours can go on planes, but I've got to worry about car sickness.
Yeah, it's worse in a car. If your dogs are not used to being in a car, it's, let me tell you, it is not pretty. But there are actually CDs that you can get of music that are tuned to a dog's ear. I kid you not. And as long as you don't mind listening to classical music for 5 days straight tuned to a dog's ear, it can be very helpful.
You've mentioned Garrett a few times during our conversation. How hard is having a real relationship in a business like this? And where'd you meet that guy?
Oh, my Lord. We were pioneers. We met on the internet when there was no Tinder. Not that I would have been on Tinder, you know me.
Swipe left for Whitney.
But we met on the internet, and I had this rule that I would not approach a guy first. I would not do it. Because I know how guys are. You all like the game. You know, maybe it's changed now. but I would not do it. So every day, you know, you'd log on and there'd be somebody, they'd give you a list of like new guys. And I was like, oh, God. Oh, look at that one. You know, no way. Wasn't going to hit him up. And I actually looked at his profile. It's like, no, he's not interested in me. You know, I was interested in the relationship. He was not. I said, well, I'm not approaching him. Next day, he writes me. And I try to talk him out of it. I'm like, dude, I'm not. Listen, I saw what you want. I saw what you're looking for. I'm not your girl. Oh, no, please. I go, no, I'm older than I said I was, you know.
No. So what was he looking for that you said no?
He did not want a relationship. He was looking for casual, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, eh, I'm too old for casual, you know. And I don't know. I think that was like the end of June. And I think I met him like July 5th, which, by the way, ladies, if you're still internet dating, 5 days is too long to wait. We have a saying at the big time, which is swipe right, meet tonight. That's, you know, as long as you've Googled them, made sure they're not serial killers and stuff. Then don't waste your chemistry online, because you can develop a chemistry with someone online, meet them in person, and there's no chemistry. And that guy now knows your entire life history. You know, it just, don't waste your time with these months and all of this stuff that people do sometimes. So it was 5 days. I was dating like a mofo. It was an insane kind of thing. It wasn't as casual as it is now. You know what I mean? It's very casual now with the Tinders and the whatever else the kids are using these days.
Well, so what was your dating like then before Tinder? You said it was, you know, you were out there and you were all over the place. So what was that like? It wasn't casual.
It wasn't casual. I was, my whole thing was, I'm not out here to be, I wanted a relationship is what I wanted. I didn't want to be dating five different people at one time. But like I said, this is a long time ago and not that many people were online. So somehow I was in demand. And I had, I've always said this. I started doing it in February. I went that whole spring and into July 5th, not buying a meal. Like, if I needed coffee, someone would buy it. If I needed lunch, someone would buy it. And it was exhausting. And this was literally, this June 30th was my last day online. It was my last day online. And I had these dates set up. And I had a date after Garrett. And I walked into the restaurant and he was sitting there and I had to make up, it's so embarrassing. I didn't make a beeline, go into the bathroom and compose myself. I don't know. I felt like the chemistry across the room was very odd, because knowing that he was the guy who didn't want a relationship. And I literally caught my breath and I excused myself about an hour later to go to the bathroom to cancel my next date. And, you know, the rest is history.
So you were tightly booked at that time.
You don't even know. It's embarrassing. It was embarrassing.
So,
you know, because I kept going, I was just like, I'm just me, y'all. You know, what's happening here?
You get a bunch of free meals out of it.
Yeah, I got a lot of free meals. Oh, my God, that was incredible. Yeah, now, I don't know. Who's buying dinner now, Dave? Do you date?
No. Well, maybe. That's a topic that we'll go off the podcast on.
Dating, I understand, gets you in a lot of hot water with you, like your husband or wife. So that's why I don't do it.
Hey, so how long ago was this before you made that commitment to Garrett?
That was July 5th, 2000.
Wow. Good for you.
All right. Dude, he just hit me at the right time. I was tired.
No, you got the right one. Did you have some real turds in your life as a radio person before?
You know, I made a real decision never to date a listener, which I know is a code that guys don't abide by. And
Why'd you go quiet? Wait, why'd you go quiet, like waiting for me to respond to that one? No, I agree.
Did you have a response?
Never.
Really? Good for you.
Well, I take that back. People who I would meet later on who were listeners, but not someone who would call and, you know, and win some contest, but people I would meet, you know, later in life or, you know, in some social setting who just happened to be listeners.
Sure. Yeah. Totally different thing, right? Dating off the request line is just not cool. There's an imbalance of power also, you know? I think that I dated one guy very early in my career who was a listener, and he took me out on New Year's Eve, to a party where I met his girlfriend. You see what I'm saying? It just doesn't, it doesn't work. That was like, what kind of idiot is he? He said, I'm not going out. I'm like, dude, we've had this date for 2 weeks. And so what does he do? He takes me to the party where his girlfriend is. What in the, what is happening?
Well, that reminds me, when you were a little girl, you didn't want to be the woman on the air that took someone's boyfriend.
Right.
Where did that come from?
Well, I used to listen to radio a lot. And girls were always talking like this. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, keep going.
And I'm driving up to Eureka with a friend of mine, just going on vacation. And I hear this girl, true story, and I hear her talking like this, just working like the overnight. I said to my friend, I can get this chick's job, man. I will not do office work anymore. I will do radio. And by the way, I'll never sound like I'm going to steal your boyfriend. God is my witness, within 3 months, I had her job.
Now, that's not in your bio. That would be her job.
Yeah, and I didn't try to. I didn't have her fired. But she ended up quitting, and I had gotten hired across. I first got hired at a restaurant, and they were like, we'd love you to be the manager. I'm like, I can't, dude. I got to get into radio. And they go, you know Dick. I can't remember Dick's last name. Do you know Dick, blah, 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 down the street? I'm like, I don't. They go, well, he runs the radio station. Why don't we introduce you? I said, cool. So I was running an automation system, and this girl worked across town, and within 3 months, she quit. I applied for a job, and I got it. Isn't that crazy?
So obviously, you don't like that seductive voice. I mean, you have one anyway, but you don't go to it as your on-air voice.
No, I don't go to it on a regular basis at all, because I just, it's not me. Like I said, I'm not cool. You know what I mean? I'm just not cool. It would be an act. That's what I'm saying. For some people, maybe it's not an act. For me, it would be a huge act.
And you knew as a 5-year-old that this is what you wanted to do.
Yeah, it was this or be a veterinarian. And the reason I didn't become a vet, couple reasons, horrible in math, which meant horrible at biology, which meant, you know, just chemistry would have been terrible for me. And I did work in the animal hospital for a while, and I never got used to, man, when old people had to bring in their old pets, you know, for the final ride.
Brutal.
Never got over it. Had to wear sunglasses, had kept a pair of sunglasses in my desk, and I never got over it. And so since I couldn't do that, my dad had bought me a transistor radio that I fell asleep listening to all the time. And I never heard any women on the air, really. But that's what I decided I wanted to be at the radio station, because as a little kid, I didn't understand radio. So I thought these bands were showing up at the stations, you know, singing their songs. I'm like, dude, I want to meet these guys. So that's how it all ended up, I think. You know, blame my dad. God bless him, you know, because he had my back the whole time.
So you moved from SoCal to Eureka.
SoCal to Eureka, yeah. And that was just to get away. And ended up hearing the girl talked like this.
Yes.
Ended up getting a job, stayed there for 2 years. And it was beautiful. The weather got to me because it's very rainy up there. And, you know, growing up in Southern California, rains almost day. Anomaly. Except when it does rain, you know, all hell breaks loose. But Eureka, it rains every day, and it was the weather. It's so beautiful up there, but I couldn't function in the weather. So I went to San Diego, the most perfect place on the face of the earth.
Oh, gosh,
you know?
what a place that was. And
I know.
You were doing 10 to 2 at night at Q, right?
Yeah. So I had all day to enjoy it.
Now, you made it sound like a magic carpet ride, you know, Eureka, San Diego, L.A., but obviously some bumps, and we talked about leaving KISS. At what point did you realize this wasn't all fun and games, this was a business, and sometimes a bad business?
I actually think at Q106, believe it or not, our boss was intense, to say the least, and I really was interested in music. And he was great because he held music meetings. And anyone could come to the music meetings.
I remember those.
But you had to commit to the music meetings. Now, you could only miss 2 music meetings. And if you missed 2, yeah, I think if you missed your second one, you were out. Didn't matter if you were sick. Didn't matter if it was vacation. Didn't matter if... I'm trying to remember all the things that it was. It's just, Oh, it didn't matter how long you lived there. You worked there. It wasn't 2 a year. It wasn't 2 6 months. It was if you missed two, you were done. And I lived very far away, and I got off work at 2 o'clock in the morning. Those music meetings were at 10 a.m. So I would go home, get home about 3 a.m., try to fall asleep, get up, drive back down to the station by 10 a.m., and then do it all again to go on the air at 10 o'clock at night. And I just thought, this is incredibly unfair, you know? Whether it was unfair or not, I can't make the call. His rules, whatever. I couldn't play with him. And I just realized how rough that was. And then he did jock meetings on Friday mornings at 10 a.m. So it was the same thing, you know? I couldn't do these music meetings on a Tuesday at 10 a.m., turn around and do jock meetings on Friday at 10 a.m. I couldn't do it, you know?
You reminded me, Whit, station, I'll leave the station out and the PD out, but I was doing overnight, so I'm off at 6 in the morning, and we had staff meetings his first week there. He wanted to show who was boss at 10 in the morning.
Yeah, they don't remember that you have overnight people on your staff.
Didn't care, and so I told him, like, hey, maybe you could, I lived in San Jose, that's an hour drive away. Hey, maybe we could just conference call or something like that. He's, hey, dude, if you're not at the meetings, you don't work here.
Yeah.
And then, oh, I'm going to vent just for a second. So then our very first meeting, we're all in the room. Of course, I'm the sleepiest one there. He said, hey, I'm excited about the direction of our station. I just wanted to be clear, you know, who our target is. We're looking at 18 to 34 women in San Jose. See you tomorrow, everybody.
Oh, no.
I know exactly what you're going through. You know, someone's showing who's boss, and you know where you are, you know, in the pecking order. And that was for a whole week of little bullshit meetings like that.
Wow. Oh, that's when I realized, you know, this was not fun. And then working for Scott, I learned a lot working for Scott, but he also wasn't easy. But Scott scared people, whereas he didn't scare me. I think he actually scared me like twice, but once I realized he really wasn't a bad guy. I was a huge Dodger fan. Not that I'm still not, but I mean, back then I could quote the stats. And I'd gone to a Dodger game, and they had won. It had come from behind. I did a break on it. And Scott could, the entry to the studio was behind us. Scott could push the door open, come in, make us feel, turn around and be out before that door closed, right? He would, this while you're on the air, and he would just hit and run. And he opened that door when I finished that break. I said, don't you ever be talking about the Dodgers on my radio station. It's apparent you don't know what you're talking about. Well, that did it. That fired me up because I knew everything. I started my next song. I ran out of that studio. I tracked him down in the bathroom, and I flung the door open. I said, I've been a Dodger fan since blah, 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 blah. Don't you ever tell me I don't know what I'm talking about when it comes to the Dodgers. And I left before the door could hit my ass on the way out. And he literally came back in, I want to say, 20 minutes later, opened the door again, opens the door. All right, you can talk about the Dodgers. Boom. And door closes, conversation over. But I did that to him twice where I was just like, you are so full of shit. He would just do it to intimidate you. And I was like, I am not intimidated by you. At all. I was there when Rick Monday intercepted the flag. Some guy set on fire in center field. I was at that game, dude. I can tell you anything you want to know about the Dodgers.
I talked to you the day after Gibson hit the home run.
Oh, dude, that day. That was the most. I'm still waiting. That was in San Diego, and I said to myself, I was moving to L.A. Like, I think I knew by then I was moving to L.A. What did I? No, I couldn't have known by then. But I, at the start of that game, I had to come up to L.A. that night. I was in San Diego. At the start of that game, Gibson wasn't even playing. He was not even playing. And I said, I was on the phone with my mom, and I said, Mom, I'm not leaving the house till Gibby hits one out of the park. My mom's like, well, you know, he's not even playing tonight. I'm like, well, you know, we'll see. Like, I know everything. And I'll never forget that moment. Yeah. So you know what a Dodger fanatic I was. Okay. Now that I live here, I'm still waiting. What are y'all doing?
30 years, 31 years and counting.
Yeah, exactly.
I am so proud of you. Hey, so where can people hear your show and you know, give us the hours and you know how to get it online, et cetera?
Sure. Well, if you go to the Big Time Online com. There's a station finder. Now, we just redid the I should actually look, but we literally just did the website a couple days ago. We lost all of our, you know, everything, so we had to redo it. There's a station finder, and if not, there's a magnifying glass up there on the right-hand side, I'm sure. Are you looking at it now? And if you type in your zip code, I think it'll give you a station. We're at 150 of them. Wow. Do you see it?
I'm going to type it in right now. There it is. I'm on it right now.
So the bigtimeonline.com. Now, it was in the top right-hand corner.
Wait, there it is. On the top tabs, you've got home, Whitney, big news, big videos, big pics, and stations. And there you type
there
it
you
in.
There you go. Awesome.
So they can get you.
So that's how you find us.
Man, I am so excited to talk to you. You know, you didn't want to be the girl that would, you know, steal the boyfriends, but you stole me a long time ago.
And, Dave.
I'm super proud of you. And hey, let's give out your social media information too. How can people follow Whit, comment with Whit, see your pictures, and be a part of your life?
Yeah, Instagram is Whitney and Company at Instagram. Whitney Allen at Facebook. I have a private page though, so you know, I might let you in, I might not. But you can go to the Big Time. You know, I put a lot of stuff up there. You see, there's like stupid stuff though. I have a boring life. It's like my dogs are up there, my boat's up there, my electric boat. It's nothing good. You know what I'm saying? The Big Time with Whitney Allen on Facebook. That's where you get all the country music news and all that kind of stuff. So that's what I got.
Hey, how has social media changed your life as a professional? I know it's completely different than when we started, when you had to actually edit tape with razor blades and never comment on politics and stay away from it. So now it's a completely different world with that.
Yeah, you know what bugs me is that I literally got into radio so that I wouldn't have to brush my hair. And now every time I turn around, somebody wants something on video. I'm like, dude, you know, even doing a Skype with you here with the camera is freaking me out. You know, because now everything is social media, and everyone who's, you know, younger than me is great at it. No one has any fear. 25 selfies. They don't care what they look like. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I look like shit. Here's a picture of me. It's like, oh my God, good for you. I can't do that. I'm not a camera person. I never have been. I got offered TV twice when I was in San Diego, and I just like, oh man, I too much work. I don't want to do the makeup. I don't want to do the hair. I don't do wardrobe. You know, it's very different. I like being able to show off the cool stuff. Like, you know what I mean? But I am not social media ready ever. Ever. Are you? I mean, you seem really comfortable doing all this stuff.
It's an acquired thing. It's a part of the biz now, unfortunately. You know, I'd rather just do a good job and leave me alone and let people love it or not love it. But now it's, you know, you have to be Instagramming. You got to be tweeting. You got to have all your Facebook pages. So
I know.
Regrettably, you know, it's a part of our world now, and you have to do it. In fact, for some folks, some gigs is like required. You know, it's a required part of the job.
I know it. I know. And they even look now with advertising, they're looking at you and, you know, are you an influencer or not? It's like, oh, dude, you know, I just got up, you know?
Yeah.
it's a lot more to do now, although getting information is so much easier. I mean, did you get all of your prep off USA Today, the life section?
Every day.
That's all we had. That, and maybe there was one prep sheet that got sent out once a week. And we had to live on that thing.
I did an interview with Danny Glover in 1991. I went to the library going through microfiche and, you know, magazine articles, you know, to get the information to talk to him the next morning.
Yeah. Oh, microfiche. Been there. I know. So that's the part of social media that I love. You know, being an active part of social media is probably the hardest thing for me. It's hard for me.
Well, the radio you've mastered, so forget that other stuff. You're great at that craft, and I'll continue to be a fan.
Oh, Dave. Thanks, man. One day I want to interview you because I want to know, were you ever a Crazy Dave or a Dr. Dave?
Well, I was a Dr. Dave as the DJ name.
You were a Dr. Dave.
Yeah, that was... I had that name in San Diego, so Gary Wall, you know, let me stick with that. That was my San Bernardino name, and it was still Dr. Dave down there.
Okay, cool. I couldn't remember why. I was like, now he was a Crazy Dave, but I worked with Crazy Dave at KS103, and I couldn't remember. Was he a Dr. Dave? He must have been a Dr. Dave. Every Dave has to be a doctor or a crazy.
Yeah, that was a great life and a great station. That was one of the best stations I've ever worked at.
Oh, yeah. So it was so great. It was just... That was on fire. That station was on fire.
Hey, before I let you go, who were your female role models? And I know you said there weren't many, but even on that station, we had Gail on overnights. You had Anita Rush middays. Who were the women out there that said, you know what? Those women kick ass. I'd like to be like them.
Candy Chamberlain, KFRC. I used to drive between LA and Eureka or San Francisco because I had a lot of friends in the Bay Area. Candy Chamberlain slayed me. I loved her. And there was also a girl who did overnights at, you know, on KMPC in Los Angeles. More of a talk show. I mean, I think they played music, but they were very personality driven. No idea where she is now. Her name was Kathy Gorey, and she was a comedian. And she had this slot. And I thought, oh my God, this chick's so refreshing. And a woman who also was on a talk. I listened to talk radio when I was a preteen, if you can believe that. Talk radio. There was a woman named Carol Hemingway, who I thought was the most brilliant interviewer. You know, at my wise age of 13, I learned so much on her show. But because there were no top 40 jocks, seriously, when I was coming up, I don't remember. You know, so Candy Chamberlain was my man. When I found her on KFRC, that's my bucket list station. Man, if I could have done one shift there. Just to say KFRC. Best call letters of all time, KFRC. So, yeah. So those are my three broads who got me through, you know, being the chick.
Wow. You're the big time. The big time with Whitney Allen. And I look forward to listening to you for many years to come. You've had a great career, and I'm super proud of you. Always love for you.
Love you, Dave. Thanks so much. It's really such an honor. And also, who gets to sit around and talk for an hour? I don't get to do this. This was, like, relaxing.
Much love for you always, Whitney Allen. The executive producer of the podcast is Hunter Lewis. Please subscribe on YouTube, iTunes, and Google Play. Your positive feedback and comments certainly help us out a lot. We really appreciate it. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time. We'll be right back.